Welcome to Motivated to Lead Podcast, helping you become a better leader. I'm your host, Mark Klingsheim. Hi, everyone. Thanks again for joining us for our podcast this week. My name is Mark Klingsheim with SEMA Partners. Each week, we interview leaders and they share lessons learned from their careers. This week, we're happy to have with us Bruce Tolgan. Bruce is an internationally known advisor, consultant. He's a best-selling author, and he has written a new book entitled The Art of Being Indispensable at Work, Win Influence, Beat Overcommitment, and Get the Right Things Done. He's got some very practical things he's going to share that will help you become a better leader, and looking forward to our conversation today with Bruce. It's great to have Bruce joining us, and Bruce, appreciate you taking time out to talk to us today.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. It's an honor and a pleasure.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I guess first off, can you give us just a little bit of your story, a little bit of your background and your career?
Yeah, so we've been doing research on the front lines of the workplace for 27 years. Back in the early 90s, I was an unhappy lawyer working at number two Wall Street, and I got curious about some of what was being said about young people in the workplace. Back then, I was young, and I started interviewing young people, and I did, my first book was Managing Generation X, which came out, you know, right in the 90s when people were like, well, why should we care what young people think? And so that book kind of hit a nerve. And for 27 years, we've been doing in-depth interviews on the front lines of the workplace. We've interviewed more than 500,000 people from more than 400 organizations over the last 27 years. And all of our work is based on that. So we have three longitudinal studies, one on human capital management, one on generational change in the workplace, and one on leadership and management. And everything we do is based on that ongoing research.
Well, I asked this question of almost every guest that we have on, and it sounds like you made a transition earlier in your career. But knowing what you know now, what advice would you give yourself at the age of 22?
You know, I went to law school for 3 years and then I practiced law for 428 days. And so, you know, sure. I kind of think, you know, I wonder sometimes if it's worth it that my mother-in-law can say, but my son-in-law is a lawyer. And and periodically my father will say, well, surely we paid for law school. Surely you have something to say about this. But, you know, I do sometimes wonder if maybe a PhD in organizational behavior would have been a better move, or an MBA. Or, you know, maybe with all that money, I could have bought a Subway franchise or something. I don't know.
Right. Yeah, that's great. So is there any advice that you received early on that you wish you would have ignored?
Gosh, you know, when I was in law school, I had a mentor going way back who had said to me, you know, if you're going to go to law school, you got to work as a lawyer. And so I went to a law firm. I guess I'm not unhappy that I did that. But, you know, as I get older, you know, I think 428 days, what could I have done with that time? I'm at a stage in my life now where I think of a lot of sliding doors. You know, I could have been a doctor, but I threw up in the sixth grade when we were dissecting frogs. So that just, it went out the window, you know? And then, you know, sometimes I think of all the different things I could have done. I'm pretty happy with where I am. Yeah, I mean, I guess there was one point in my life where somebody told me, you know, Bruce, there's more to life than karate. And then for 6 years, I didn't practice as intensely. I regret that. Because it turns out there's not more to life than karate.
Okay. And we'll talk about that towards the end of the broadcast, things you do to unwind, and definitely interested in that. So you've got a book that came out and you timed it perfectly. The Art of Being Indispensable at Work, Win Influence, Beat Overcommitment, and Get the Right Things Done. And you probably had it all planned out that you would release that book right as COVID was starting, right?
You know, of course, I did not write that for the pandemic, but I almost feel like I might as well have.
Yeah.
You know, the reason I did that book is because, you know, I spend a lot of time in organizations And much of our work is about strengthening chain of command leadership, helping, you know, engineers who become leaders figure out how to do the basic work of managing, accountants who become leaders, how to do the basic work of managing, entrepreneurs who become leaders, how to do the basic work of managing. And what I found was the in larger, more complex organizations, and even in smaller organizations, people kept telling me, you know, okay, but the hardest thing for me now is I deal with so many people. Up, down, sideways, diagonal, and everyone's coming to me with asks, with requests. And, you know, I'm inundated by requests from all over the organization, and I'm forced to rely on people all over the organization, inside and outside the organization, whom I can't hold accountable. So what do I do? And of course, you know, what I was finding was people said, oh, well, if you don't have authority, you have to use influence. And then I'd ask people about that and they'd be like, well, that doesn't help at all, you know? Right. And so that's what led me to try to figure out, well, who is succeeding in this environment? Who is not going bananas? Because, you know, I talk to CEOs and they say, oh, it's the collaboration revolution. We're speeding up decision-making. We're speeding up productivity and quality. You know, we're sharing information. We have a global organization. People have to be good at so many things that we, you know, we have to collapse silos and hierarchies and, you know, and then, but I talk to people and they're like, but it's driving us crazy. So what I was trying to figure out was, well, who has figured this out? And once I started to find, the answer to that riddle, then I thought, okay, this is an important book.
So talk a little bit about, and I know you wrote an article that was in the Harvard Business Review, Learn When to Say No. And I think people are seemingly, they are overwhelmed during this time, even though they're working virtually, a lot of people are. There seems to be a lot of things that they have to make decisions on. Talk a little bit about that thought. You talk about it in the book.
Yes. So you want to be indispensable. You want to be one of these go-to people. Like, how do you make sure that no matter what happens, you're one of the people that everybody's like, well, we got to keep that guy, you know, or we got to keep that person. Right. I use the term guy as a gender neutral term. Okay. And so, you know, if you want to be that indispensable go-to person, then there's a huge amount of pressure to say yes. Right. People come to you. You want to say yes. You want to be a good team player. You want to be valuable. You want to help out. You want other people to want to help you. And so what ends up happening, though, is you say yes, 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 until you become overcommitted. What we found was that the people who were the best at their jobs, had the best attitude, and were the hardest workers, that they had a basic tenet, which was they wanted to say yes, but that they said yes as much as they possibly could until they were overwhelmed. And then they said no, because they were overwhelmed. And, you know, the fundamental learning there was that's not a strategic way to make decisions about how to allocate your productive capacity. To say yes, 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 because you want to be a good sport. And then to say no, 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 because you're overwhelmed. It turns out that's not a good strategy. And what we found was that the people who were most consistently indispensable go-to people over time were the ones who slowed down at the point of the ask. Whether they were making a request or receiving a request, they slowed down and really fine-tuned the ask so that decisions about yes and no were made with much greater due diligence. And so that became the hub. In fact, the original title of the book was When to Say No and How to Say Yes. And then Harvard was like, no, we're going to call it The Art of Being Indispensable at Work. And then I was like, but if somebody's indispensable, that's a huge business problem. If I had I'd tell a CEO, we got to deal with that. You know, and they were like, no, no, sure. No, it's fine. You know, you know, and I think, you know, people think, oh, we got to learn how to say no. Well, no matter how much you sugarcoat no, it's still no. The key to getting away with, to having power to say no, is having a reputation for making really good decisions.
But how do you make great decisions?
Yeah, so the most important learning that we had out of our research, so what I do is I go through the research and try to find well, what is working here? And if it's counterintuitive, it's counterintuitive. That's better for book sales. But I don't care if it's counterintuitive. I just want it to be real, you know? So what I found was that so often when people make requests, their requests are not well formed. They may not be going to the right person. They may not know what that person really does. Sometimes they don't even understand what they need. Or they don't understand where their needs meet up with what the other person or team or organization can do. And so what we found was if people slow down at the point of the request, and that means really tune in, really try to understand and help the other person understand what it is they really need and where that meets up with what you do. And then, you know, some no's are easy. I can't do that. I actually can't do that. Well, okay, that no is pretty easy. And then the question is either what can you do or who can do this, right? I'm not allowed to do that. Or sometimes it's like, you're asking me this. It's not just I'm not allowed to do that. You're not allowed to do that. You know? And then sometimes you can do everybody a big favor by being like, we're not allowed to do that, you know? And then it's, you know, where it's harder is where you have to make a real business decision. Should we do that? And it turns out that the more you drill down on the request, the more you, so the fundamental thing that we're teaching people now is when somebody comes to you with a request, slow down, ask questions, take notes. Don't just let that wash over you. Yeah. I'll get to that. Or no, I'm overwhelmed. But let me try to understand what's going on here. And then where all the action is yes. Yes is where all the action is. But yes means it's got to be a really clear plan. Let's make sure we understand what needs to happen, how it needs to happen. So, you know, for most individuals, what this means is, you know, is this one of my specialties? And if it's not one of my specialties, is this an opportunity to expand my repertoire of specialties? But if so, I shouldn't like learn on the sly. I need to be really clear that, hey, this is not my specialty. I'm willing to dig into this, but, you know, I'm going to have to do some learning first and I'm going to need your help.
Good. Well, we have a number of our listeners that are first-time leaders and they've moved into a position and some of them have probably taken on responsibility during the last, you know, 10, 11 months. Talk a little bit. I saw an article, I believe it was for Fast Company that you wrote talking about the importance of celebration. I don't know if I'm quoting the right resource, but talk a little bit about that as you're leading during this time and that it can be draining as far as all the turmoil that's going on in our world and dealing with COVID and all that. Talk a little bit about that, the importance of celebration.
Yeah, celebration and thanks and recognition and reward. And that's true, especially if you're in a leadership role. If I always tell people, if somebody sits at their dinner table and talks about their boss and they're talking about you, that is a huge responsibility. Don't take it lightly. And set people up for success. Don't just manage when things go wrong. And then when things go right, keep score. So many leaders, they keep score when things go wrong. But when things go right, you got to keep score and help people keep score for themselves. And one of the things we found when this is true, not just if you're in a leadership role, but also with sideways colleagues and diagonal colleagues, that, you know, when things go wrong, there's a lot of blaming and finger pointing, right? When things go right, we move on to the next thing. And then we try to build rapport by shooting the breeze and being buddies with each other. But when the work goes wrong, the relationships go wrong. And when the work goes right, we don't stop and celebrate. So, you know, I hear this all the time from people. We don't stop and celebrate enough when things go right. And so, you know, we do a lot of work with the United States Armed Forces and have for 25 plus years. One of the things I love about how the military operates is, of course, they don't have an easy job. They don't pay a lot, you know, and people are shooting at them. God bless them and keep them safe. I often say to my private sector clients, you know, at least nobody's shooting at you.
Right.
You know, of course you can't say that as much anymore, but God, so such crazy times. But, you know, so look, after every significant project, task, or responsibility in the military, they do what's called an after action review. And so they stop and say, what went right? And let's celebrate that. What went wrong and how can we do better? We don't point fingers, but let's get better together. Mm-hmm. And then let's look around the corner for the next time this is likely to come up. And let's try to have some prepared plans of action. Let's try to have some repeatable solutions. Let's have some ways of going forward on this so that whatever went right goes right again. And whatever went wrong, you know, we do better on that. And frankly, you know, people say to me, well, whoa, what do people want? A medal? Well, what most people want is if they do more, better, faster, they want to get paid more, right? What most people want after that is more control over their own schedule, right? What most people want after that is more interesting tasks and responsibilities. What most people want after that is learning opportunities, more control over their work location and conditions. So, you know, people want to get a reward, especially if you're their boss. But if you're not their boss, right, what about a really good thank you? And I'll tell you a very simple technique that we've been sharing with folks, because people so often say, well, I don't have any rewards to offer. You know, I don't have any power. I don't have authority. So, and I don't have any, you know, I don't have rewards to offer. I could give them a gift card or something, but, you know, and one of the things our research shows is there's a big absence of a really old fashioned thing, which is thank you, right? The people just don't say thank you enough. And then so, how do you make a thank you really powerful? And one of the things I've been teaching people is, you have the power to issue a letter of commendation to anyone. All you do is put your thank you in writing, put in the details, and CC a bunch of people. And that's how you take a thank you and make it into a letter of commendation. So what do they want, a medal? Well, you know, it may not be a medal, but they could actually frame it.
Yeah, it's good stuff. And yeah, something that I think people, whenever you get a thank you note that's handwritten, you know, that stands out. You know, I think back over the last year and I've received some thank you notes and they've stood out because you just don't get those often now.
Yeah. And by the way, let me just add one thing to that, because I think you're so right that's, you know, look, in this newfangled world, old fashioned things like a written thank you are really powerful. But I do want to say that, you know, putting details in and sharing it with others is a way to really pour gasoline on that thank you.
Yeah, great. Great tip. So you wrote a book 14 years ago, I believe. It's Okay to Be the Boss. Talk a little bit about that book. And again, I think that'd be a great one for our listeners to pick up besides your most recent book, but talk a little bit about the thoughts behind that book.
Yeah. So that came out of earlier research where we found that so many people move into positions of supervisory responsibility because they're very good at something, but not necessarily because they're good at managing people. And then what they do is they kind of, somebody teaches them how to do a little bit of extra paperwork, right? But nobody teaches them how to do the people work. And so what they do is they wing it and they see what other people have done. You know, maybe they go to a leadership seminar and somebody says, seek to understand their deep inner motivations, light a fire in their belly, have them work only in their area of passion and strength. And I've had so many leaders say to me, passion and strength, well, who's going to do all the work?
Right.
Right. And help them find a best friend at work. That's my favorite. Right. Because people are like, no, I have my own friends. Thanks. What we find is that what leaders typically do is they touch base. Hey, how's everything going? Everything on track? Any problems I should know about? And then they say, hey, later on, my door is always open. I'm just a phone call away. What happens then is we interrupt each other all day long. Right? Something pops into your head, you send a text. Something pops into your head, you pick up the phone. Something pops into your head, you send an email. And they say, well, I thought we're supposed to communicate. So we communicate by touching base and by interrupting. And then we're on email together. And then we have the occasional team meeting. Often they're not very good. although they're getting better because we're forced to now, so much structure and substance is being forced on us by the pandemic. What happens is problems hide below the radar. And the finding we had was that the most substantive conversations in most management relationships don't happen until things go wrong and people are frustrated and angry. But nobody's at their best when they're being frustrated and angry. Just like nobody's at their best when they're being interrupted. So we were looking for, okay, well, what is the evidence-based best practice here? And it turns out it's take a walk every day and eat your vegetables, right? It's like sending a written thank you note. It's take a walk every day and eat your vegetables. It's high structure, high substance communication. Have team huddles for what team huddles are good for. Make them brief, straight, simple, organized, and conduct them by discipline. And then have structured one-on-ones because everybody's different. What one person needs from you is different from what another person needs from you. What you need from one person is different from what you need from another person. So high structure, high substance one-on-ones, it's not where you talk at people, but you engage in a structured dialogue about the work. And where what you're doing as a leader is you're always trying to help somebody do more, better, faster, get better at their job, have clear expectations, keep score for themselves when they're winning, have help troubleshooting, problem solving, resource planning, and get the recognition and reward that they need. What we found was 9 out of 10 managers don't practice the basics. And as a result of that, problems occur that didn't have to occur. Problems get out of control. Resources are squandered. People go in the wrong direction. Low performers hide out. High performers get frustrated. Managers have a hard time delegating. And so what we found was the number one thing we could do, and we did this at TGI Fridays. We did it at Walmart, right? We did it in hospitals. We did it in accounting firms. We did it in insurance, big insurance companies. Was the number one thing you could do was teach managers to have a regular structured dialogue with people. What are you going to do? How are you going to do it? What and how can I help you? And every day, every other day, once a week, some people, you talk to them for 10 minutes every morning and they go from being a mediocre performer to a high performer. Some people talk to them once a week. Some people every other week, but everybody's different. Some people you talk about the details. Some people you talk about the big picture. Some people need a fire lit in their belly. Some people need a fire lit under their chair.
So as you're thinking about and talking to other leaders in industry, is there anything that they're doing that, you know, again, I hear a lot of people saying I'm getting zoomed out. I spend so much time on the screen every day, and that's kind of how I'm communicating with my team. Any tips that you could share that would be helpful just to keep everybody aligned and connected? You mentioned kind of the check-ins, and it can be different for each person what they need versus just scheduling meetings to schedule them. Because I've heard people say that, you know, we're not traveling to meetings now, but we can overschedule now our meetings because we don't have that time in between. Any thoughts around that?
Yeah. So for group meetings, right? There's only 3.5 reasons why you should have a group meeting. One, if you have a bunch of information to communicate to a bunch of people in the same way at the same time. Two, if you want to create a feeling of belonging and togetherness, right? Three, if they're interdependent handoffs, right? That people need to plan how they're going to rely on each other. Or there's brainstorming, right? An open question. So people need to hear each other and respond spontaneously to each other. And then the half reason is that group meetings so often make it clear that what's really necessary here is a one-on-one, right? That's really, you got to talk to Mr. Blue. You got to talk to Mr. Blue. And then have a tight agenda and teach people to follow good meeting discipline and have them brief, straight, simple. Have team huddles for what team huddles are good for and make them count. And then build a regular structured one-on-one dialogue with each person based on what they need. Who is this person at work? Why are you meeting with this person? So now what sometimes happens is managers say, oh, do you want to have a one-on-one? No, I'm all set. All right, call me when you need me. And we go right back to managing by interruption and firefighting. Don't do that, right? What we recommend is teach your people to keep a running list of what they need to talk to you about and what are decisions they need made, problems they need help with, interdependency they need help with, resources they need help planning. And you know, what are they planning to do? Priorities that they need help aligning. And have your direct reports, you got to teach them how to do their part in the relationship. And have them send you a punch list once a week or twice a week or every other week. And then have that one-on-one and make it count and take notes. Document. Keep score for people and help people keep score for themselves.
Yeah. Great thoughts around that. So tell me, during this time we talked a little bit, you mentioned karate. I'm guessing that's probably on your list of things you do outside of work to recharge. Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah. So my house is right side by side with my office. In my office, we got a suite of offices here and we got a dojo. And I've been doing karate since I was 7 years old and I'm 53. So my lifelong teacher, he was my teacher when I was 7 years old. He lives with us. This is his retirement gig. Uh-huh. And now the problem is that karate involves a lot of punching and kicking each other. And so, you know, we're not allowed to touch or breathe on each other. But I'm in the dojo every day and working out every day. And, you know, exercise, I think, look, you know, you got to keep your body strong, got to keep your mind strong. So doing a lot of reading. My wife is just finishing up her second book. And so I've been that's what I'm reading right now. And it's going to be a blockbuster. It's called Madam. And it's focuses on a 1920s era madam, and her first book won the Pulitzer Prize. So we're very hopeful about this one.
Wow. That's great. Well, talk a little bit about, you've got six books that you've written. Is that correct?
I mean, if you count all of them, there's 21, but okay. A lot of them are really short. Okay. And one of them's only in print in Korean now.
Okay. So.
but there are six that we send out.
Sure. Got it. So
you know, one of them is called Not Everyone Gets a Trophy. That was my book about the millennials. And so my first book was Managing Generation X when I was a young upstart. By the time I got old and curmudgeonly, I wrote a book about young people and it was Not Everyone Gets a Trophy.
Right. Yeah, I've been a soccer coach for my girls, and yeah, they all got trophies just for showing up. But tell me a little bit as far as kind of you've written books. Your wife's an author. That's interesting that you guys in the same household, so you know what writing schedules are like. But any other books that you've read that you think would be good for leaders to put on their reading list?
I mean, the books that I always, so, you know, my wife and I have been together 35 years, no children, but we periodically foster youngsters. And, you know, one of the things about the office and dojo is there are extra rooms. So we've actually had young people living here. And, you know, some of the books that I always start people out on, there's a great book called The Last Lecture by Randy Pausch. I recommend that to everyone. Make Your Bed by Admiral McRaven is an incredible book. It's a great book for young people. I love The Seven Habits, Covey's book, Seven Habits of Highly Effective People. Jonathan Livingston Seagull is one of my favorites. Siddhartha is one of my favorites. I mean, I'm just giving you my reading list. The reading list that I give others. The book I'm reading right now is I'm reading memoirs right now because I'm writing a memoir. So I'm reading a memoir right now called Heavy. I read a book, the one before that was a book called Black is the Body by Emily Bernard. It's a great memoir. She just won the LA Times Book Prize for memoir. That's a phenomenal book. I'm rereading a battlefield memoir called About Face by Colonel David Hackworth. That's an amazing book. Ben Franklin's memoir, maybe the first memoir, you know, kind of set the standard. That's a great one.
Our listeners, I know I get comments a lot as far as that they always want to be adding some additional books to their lists of things to be reading. as you think about during this time, any parting advice you'd give a leader as they're leading during this season and in our all of our collective history here?
Yeah. So the two pieces of advice I've been giving everyone are, you know, the first person you got to manage every day is yourself. The second person you have to manage every day is your boss. Third is anyone who refers to you as their boss. And then see what time you've got for everyone else, you know. And then the other piece of advice that I have is, it was shared with me by a longtime client and close friend, a guy named Greg Langell, who was Deputy Commanding General of the Joint Special Operations Command for the United States Armed Forces. Really neat guy. And he put it so well to me. He said, you know, what I've been telling people now is don't practice being your best self. Practice being the person you're trying to become. And I just think that's genius.
Yeah, that's great. Great thing to be ending our podcast on, and appreciate your time and insights, and wish you success with your book. How would somebody learn more about kind of what you're working on and what you do?
Oh, you can find us always at rainmakerthinking.com, and I'm on Twitter at Bruce Tolgan, and you know, of course, the books, The Art of Being Indispensable at Work. It's HBR. It's Harvard Business Review Press. I feel like I'm all grown up now. You know, so right. That book is available wherever books are sold.
Well, thanks, Bruce, and wish you the best in the coming year. And thanks for taking some time with us.
Oh, likewise. Gosh, thank you so much. Thanks for making it so easy and so much fun.
Thank you for listening to the Motivated to Lead podcast. Please subscribe on iTunes. You can also see a video version of this interview at motivatedtolead.com. This podcast is brought to you by SEMA Partners, helping you find your next great leader.